Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Kate, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, living with myeloproliferative neoplasms, or MPN. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other myeloproliferative organizations, as well as other cancer organizations. Because of that collaboration, we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today, and we have on the call today over 328 participants. And you come from all of the United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, Egypt, Kenya, Tunisia, and the United Kingdom. Now, today's program is going to address progress in the treatment of myeloproliferative neoplasms, or MPN. Today's program was made possible by Insight Corporation. I really want to thank them for the support, not only of today's program, but of this entire three-part series. So there's more to come besides today's program. Many of you have received from Cancer Care materials about the program today, and in those materials there is now the evaluation form, and I would ask you all to complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics you'd like us to offer going forward? Indeed, this three-part series has really been informed by the suggestions you've made to us of topics you'd like us to address going forward. And so please tell us the topics you'd like us to do. We're planning a whole bunch more series for 2015. And your thoughts and recommendations we take very seriously, and you'll often see them then in the programs that we do and we offer. Now, we have wonderful speakers, and I want to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Laura Michaels. Dr. Michaels is Associate Professor of Medicine, Medical College of Wisconsin. And Dr. Michaels is going to address an overview of myelofibrosis, polycythemia vera, and essential thrombocytopenia. And she's also going to address staging and diagnosing, current standard of care and new treatment approaches, and the role of clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Michaels.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner. As you've all heard, I work in Wisconsin. My specialty is hematologic malignancies, and in particular, the array of diseases that fall under the umbrella term of myeloproliferative neoplasms. My goals today are going to be talking a little bit about these conditions, about how we know that they are there, how a patient is diagnosed, and what they sort of grow from. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about our way that we risk stratify individuals, trying to understand a little bit about the risk that these conditions pose to the patients and how the treatments then are based on that risk. We'll talk about the common treatments for all of these three conditions, and then I'm going to give a little summation of some of the stuff that's coming down the pike, some of the novel medicines that are being looked at, and how those might be incorporated into care in the future. So I like to begin, and I begin the same way with many of my patients, as explaining how these diseases occur in an individual. One can think about the bone marrow as a garden. The garden is where all the blood cells grow, the white blood cells, red blood cells, and platelets, and they grow from what are the seeds, or stem cells. Now, these aren't the stem cells you hear about in the news, but these are stem cells that have the ability to grow into any of the blood cells of the body. Normally, the stem cells grow into the blood cells only when told to by hormones or other chemicals that circulate in the bloodstream that come from the kidneys or the liver or the lungs. But in the conditions of myeloproliferative neoplasms, or MPNs as they're nicknamed, what we see is that the bone marrow starts to grow independently. It sort of decides on its own that it's going to turn into the cells of the blood without signals to do so. When that condition involves the overproduction of red blood cells, that's called polycythemia vera. When it is the overproduction of platelets, that's called essential thrombocythemia. When it's the overproduction of cells that cause fibrosis or scarring, that's called myelofibrosis. And these stem cells are abnormal, almost like weeds. They've learned incorrectly that they need to keep producing cells. And this fundamental error inside the bone marrow is what leads to these conditions. It was originally described in the 50s, and all of them basically are marked by several common cardinal features: an overproduction of cells, an increase in the fibrosis of the bone marrow or the scarring of the bone marrow, a tendency to form blood clots or bleeding, and a risk, although small in some cases, larger in others, that this could turn into a more aggressive or even a more aggressive type of cancer called acute leukemia. Now, unlike acute leukemia, many of these conditions are relatively slow to grow and can be stable for years at a time. But because the problem lies in the seeds, the stem cells themselves, we consider the bone marrow to be fragile and to be likely or more likely to be tipped into abnormal production of cells. So that's sort of an overview of how all of these conditions arise. They're not common conditions. Polycythemia vera is slightly less common than essential thrombocythemia, the one where platelets are overproduced. And primary myelofibrosis is among the least common. So they're rare conditions, and that can affect individuals in a number of ways. First off, it makes it hard to find physicians who have lots of experience with these. It also means that you may not run into common, it may not be easy to find information on them. That's why groups like this, where you can get together with or hear from other people with these conditions and share information, is especially important. So what happens when these cells are overproduced? Like I told you, there are some cardinal features that affect everybody. But one thing you see is that these clonal MPN cells can cause problems with, one, the production of normal cells. So some people can become anemic or thrombocytopenic even when they overproduce other cells. Some people can have an enlarged spleen. A spleen is an organ in the left-hand side of the body, which when somebody is a fetus or young individual, young human, that's where our bone marrow is made. But as we grow, the bone marrow moves to the insides of the bones. Well, it turns out that if the bone marrow in the bones becomes fibrotic or scarred down, the body looks for other places for the blood cells to be made, and it turns to the spleen. So in many of these conditions, the spleen becomes enlarged because the bone marrow is looking for an alternative source, an alternative place to produce because scarring has happened in the bone marrow. It can also, these conditions also cause a lot of symptoms, and the symptoms are varied. They can be itching, they can be fatigue, they can be problems with related to migraines or headaches, numbness in the fingers or toes. We're going to get a comment from Dr. Gawin about a lot of these symptoms, but I want to be clear that although these conditions can be non-aggressive, that doesn't mean that people don't have symptoms. So now that we have an overview of it, let's talk a little bit about what the diagnosis entails. And I always have three steps to deciding how to work with a patient. The first is to confirm the diagnosis, the second is to determine the risks, and the third is to decide on therapy. Diagnosis means that every individual needs to have a complete history and physical, and a relatively detailed family history needs to be performed as well. And that's because there are rare instances where these conditions can occur in multiple family members. That's not common at all. Most of the time, no family members are involved, but a family history is important. Individuals should have complete blood counts checked, and this is because this is a disease that's also often reflected in the blood counts. One needs to check on the hormone levels of a body hormone called erythropoietin, And that hormone level can help us understand whether or not the problem lies for the high blood counts lies in the body chemistry or lies inside the bone marrow. We often do genetic testing as well. We test for a gene called the JAK2. That's the nickname. It's JAK2. And we test for a gene sometimes called calreticulin. These two allow us, again, to understand that the problem of the high blood counts lies inside the bone marrow, not based on the body's hormone system. And then most individuals with a diagnosis of myeloproliferative neoplasms, whether or not it's polycythemia vera, essential thrombocythemia, or myelofibrosis, should undergo a bone marrow biopsy with cytogenetic testing. Now, it's not always essential. There are some individuals with polycythemia vera that don't need to have a bone marrow biopsy, where you can do the diagnosis just based on the blood counts and the erythropoietin levels and some genetic testing from the blood. But most other individuals should have one, if only to confirm the diagnosis. Like every cancer diagnosis, the most important thing is making sure you have all of your primary data collected, that you've done a good job with the fundamentals before making any big treatment decisions. I think at diagnosis, there's some questions for your doctor as well. How sure are we of my diagnosis? How do we know that this isn't something that's reactive or secondary to some other disease? One needs to really be sure about this. And you sometimes want to ask whether or not the pathology from the bone marrow has been reviewed, because in some cases it can be confusing to determine the diagnosis. So reviewing the pathologists often trade around the slides that are done from the bone marrow to get another set of eyes on it, and that's something that can be done. So the next thing you do is decide what the risk is and the risk posed by the condition to the patient. And that really determines, that stems from understanding the patient's history. High-risk disease is one where somebody's had a blood clot in the past, either a arterial blood clot or a venous blood clot. Venous blood clots include things like deep venous thrombosis or pulmonary embolism. Arterial blood clots include things like heart attacks or strokes. If anybody has a condition which is a myeloproliferative neoplasm and has had a clot like that, a blood clot like that, they are considered high risk no matter what their age is. In addition, we know that in polycythemia and essential thrombocythemia, one can become at risk for these clots once they reach about the age of 60. So the risk stratification methods for these two conditions are, if you're above the age of 60 or you've had a blood clot, then you're considered in the higher risk category. And that is how that's stratified. So that's a little bit of what staging means in this. In myelofibrosis, the third kind of myeloproliferative neoplasm, the staging is based on a score. The score is called the DIPSS score, and I'm not going to go into the details about it, but it's calculated based on the need for blood transfusions, how many immature cells are in the blood, the white blood cell count, anemia, and symptoms. So in general, another question I recommend asking your physician is, what is my risk? Am I in a high-risk category, an intermediate-risk category, or a low-risk category if I have myelofibrosis? If I have polycythemia vera or essential thrombocythemia, you want to ask if you're in a high-risk or a low-risk category. The reason being is that that tells us a little bit about the need for treatment. So once your doctor starts talking about treatment, you want to ask about the reasons why you should start treatment, what would happen if you didn't, and what symptoms or toxicities will you be experiencing once treatment started. The treatment of polycythemia vera patients, for all patients, high or low risk, is that they keep their blood count under about 45% in men and under about 43% in women. And we know this because there's been an Italian study that said if the blood count is kept low, largely just by having blood withdrawn, that can decrease the risks of arterial and venous clotting and help people live longer. I also recommend that all polycythemia vera patients take a low-dose aspirin, like a baby aspirin, and that can also help reduce the risks of blood clots. And finally, patients, all polycythemia vera patients, need to pay good attention to their risk factors for heart disease, like their blood pressure, their obesity, diabetes, smoking. All those things need to be kept under very good control. In terms of lowering the blood counts with a chemotherapy or a chemotherapy-like medicine, that's generally reserved for people who are in the high-risk category, people that are 60 years or older, or that have had a prior clot in their arterial or venous circulation, or people with severe symptoms. If their platelets are very high, if their white count is getting very high, or they have severe symptoms, then we need to talk about what's called cytoreduction, meaning lowering the blood counts with chemotherapy. Sometimes that chemotherapy is a medicine called hydroxyurea. Sometimes that's a medicine called interferon alpha. And sometimes, depending on the symptoms we're treating, we consider some of the newer medicines, like this medicine that Dr. Mesmer mentioned, ruxolitinib. In essential thrombocythemia, like polycythemia patients, all patients need to be on a low-dose aspirin, and all patients need to be very aggressive about reducing their risk factors for heart disease or arterial blood clots. And again, we use medicines like hydroxyurea or interferon alpha to lower the blood counts in patients who are over the age of 60, who've had prior blood counts, or have had severe symptoms. Essential thrombocythemia, there's also another medicine that's not used in polycythemia vera called anagrelide, which can sometimes be used to lower the platelets in people where hydrea or interferon alpha are not working. Myelofibrosis is a trickier disease. It's more often hits older people, and some people can feel quite ill with it. You have to think about the symptoms, and you have to consider the patient's risks from their disease and what will be gained by the interventions. Some interventions are more higher risk, and yet they have higher reward. And in some individuals with myelofibrosis, we discuss the possibility of using a transplantation or a stem cell transplantation. That's something that needs to be undertaken after a lot of thought. If we're trying to control the spleen or the symptoms related to myelofibrosis, one of the best new medicines is the one that was introduced about 2 years ago called ruxolitinib. And this has shown excellent benefit in controlling symptoms and even increasing the length of life by decreasing the spleen size. And that's one of the first medicines that we consider when we're talking about helping a patient with symptoms or more aggressive myelofibrosis. Other medicines can, there are side effects to this and some toxicities, so of course this medicine needs to be used in consultation with your physician and after discussing it. There's also a lot of new medicines that are related to ruxolitinib or being used in combination, and often these can be offered in the context of a clinical trial. Clinical trials are a place where we test either new combinations of medicines or medicines that might be novel, meaning haven't been tried in this. And there's a lot of new medicines that have been developed in the last 5 years on this. So one thing I always ask my patients is to consider discussing clinical trials or new medicines with their physicians. Finally, I think it's good to know that with myelofibrosis, as well as with polycythemia vera and essential thrombocythemia, you need to develop a close collaborative relationship with your physician. You need to regularly talk about the status of your disease. Is there a reason that we need to think about something new? What else is out there? Because this is a dynamic and changing field. Even just this December, there's going to be new results of several new medicines, new types of medicines used for myelofibrosis and maybe eventually for polycythemia vera and essential thrombocythemia. So I would say stay tuned. And clinical trials are the ways we develop these new medicines. So I think I'll stop here, having given this overview, and let Dr. Mesmer turn. I'll turn it back over to Dr. Mesmer.
Thank you so much, Dr. Michaels. That was really so informative and just a wonderful overview. Thank you. A lot of excellent. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Christina Gowan. And Dr. Gowan is hematology and medical oncology fellow, Mayo Clinic, Arizona. And Dr. Gowan is going to address common symptoms, working with your healthcare team to manage symptoms, reducing complications of myeloproliferative neoplasms, what symptoms should prompt a call to your doctor, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Gowen.
Well, thank you, Dr. Mesner, for that kind introduction, and thank you, Dr. Michaels, for that really great overview. You know, I'm going to be speaking on quite a lot of the same issues, and I think there's going to be a little bit of overlap, but I think repetition in this very complex disease spectrum is beneficial, especially when we're trying to learn more about this disease for the first time. So to fully understand the symptoms associated with myeloproliferative neoplasms, I think it's important to have a very basic understanding of the biology and the terminology of the disease, particularly since this is the first part in a several-part series focusing on myeloproliferative neoplasms. So let's discuss what the word myeloproliferative neoplasm really means. In Latin, the word myelo refers to bone marrow, which is essentially the body's blood cell factory. Proliferative refers to the rapid growth and production of cells. And finally, neoplasm means abnormal growth of cells. So when taken all together, the phrase myeloproliferative neoplasm means an abnormal increased growth and production of blood cells from the bone marrow. So what makes up the bone marrow? The bone marrow is a system within the large bones of your body that produces the body's blood elements. Three main cells are produced within the bone marrow: red blood cells, which carry oxygen throughout the body, and it's also called hemoglobin or hematocrit; white blood cells, which help the body fight infection; and finally, platelets, which help the body form blood clots when injured and help to stop bleeding. The bone marrow is an organ which is a very delicate balance of all three of these elements within what we call the microenvironment. The microenvironment can be looked at as the soil in which the bone marrow elements grow. What happens when one has abnormal production of cells, and how does that translate into symptoms which you may experience as a patient? Too many red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets can lead to the formation of blood clots. Blood clots can be a medical emergency, and the symptoms are very important to recognize so they can be treated in a very timely manner. Blood clots can lead to a variety of symptoms, and it really is dependent on the location in which the blood clot itself is formed. A common site of blood clot formation is in the veins of the legs, and this is called deep venous thrombosis, or for short, DVT. This manifests as symptoms of redness, swelling, or pain in the affected leg. Another place blood clots may form include the lungs. This is called pulmonary embolus, or PE for short. And this may be experienced as a rapid onset of feeling short of breath or winded. Chest pain may occur and may be associated with a cough or a sense of anxiety. Clots may also form in arteries, such as arteries within the heart or within the brain, and this can lead to heart attack or strokes. Symptoms of chest pain that is worse with exertion, relieved by rest, often described as pressure with associated radiation down the arms, nausea, or sweating, are all suggestive of an ongoing heart attack, or what we call a myocardial infarction. Symptoms such as a sudden onset of weakness, difficulty speaking or walking, or numbness and tingling may represent a stroke event. Symptoms of blood clots really should be evaluated immediately by a healthcare provider, typically in an emergency room setting. So on the flip side of blood clots, there's actually a tendency to bleed, and this is kind of paroxysmal. Too many platelets, when extremely high, can lead to increased risk of bleeding. And this can lead to symptoms such as red urine, bleeding ulcers with blackening of the stool, an ease of bruising, nosebleeds, and a potential risk of post-surgical bleeding complications. So some other characteristics of the disease can lead to interesting symptoms, and Dr. Michaels touched on this a bit, with abnormal cell production in organs outside of the bone marrow can cause enlargement of other organs such as the spleen and the liver, which can lead to abdominal pain, discomfort, and a sense of feeling full rapidly, something practitioners will call early satiety. It can also lead to stretching of the spleen and the release of chemicals we call cytokines. These chemicals, when released into the bloodstream, can cause symptoms of fatigue, night sweats, bone pain, and significant weight loss. Sometimes the breakdown of all of these excess cells in the circulation can cause release of chemicals, and these chemicals can cause itching, or what practitioners call pruritus, and this particularly happens after warm showers. Blockage of very small capillaries or blood vessels in your arms or legs may cause a rash, and these rashes may appear lace-like and be associated with some general redness or some burning discomfort. Some other common symptoms include headache, difficulty concentrating, dizziness, and psychosocial symptoms, such as insomnia, depression, and sexual dysfunction. So the burden symptom, or the symptom burden associated with myeloproliferative neoplasms, really may be overwhelming and can vary profoundly amongst different patients. It is of primary importance to share your symptom burden with your primary care provider, as this often dictates therapeutic decisions and may change your doctor's treatment strategy. Symptoms that should prompt an immediate evaluation by a healthcare provider include chest pain, shortness of breath, or sudden onset of weakness or difficulty performing motor tasks such as speaking or walking, as these all may be life-threatening blood clot events such as a heart attack, stroke, or blood clot in the lung. Additionally, your physician should be notified if you develop a fever, particularly if you know you have low white blood cell counts. If your leg becomes swollen, red, or tender, or if you are unable to take your medications for any reason. And certainly, if you have developed any worsening symptoms of any kind, this should be communicated to your healthcare provider. So how can you best communicate with your healthcare team? You may be asked to complete a very specialized questionnaire to myeloproliferative disease, the NPM symptom assessment form, in your physician's office. This is a tool developed for your doctor to help you communicate your symptom burden. If this is not available at your physician's office, it's up to you to communicate your symptoms effectively. Document at home what you're experiencing so that you may address these issues when you go see your doctor at the next office visit. Often a symptom diary is very helpful to detect trends, and bring a list of your symptoms with you so none are forgotten during that office visit. Remember, your healthcare team extends to many other providers beyond your primary care provider or hematologist. And this includes nurses, nutritionists, social workers, pharmacists, among others. Be sure to engage all members of the team to get the most information possible and to optimize treatment strategies. For example, a nutritionist can give helpful advice if you're experiencing weight loss. A pharmacist may help optimize your medication list to decrease side effects. And a social worker may help identify social networks, which may offer support. So it should be noted that psychosocial disturbance, such as insomnia, anxiety, and depression, are very common among the spectrum of diseases. Be sure to get the help you need and be honest with yourself and your provider regarding this particular symptom complex. Medical and behavioral therapies can be instrumental in treating depression, anxiety, and sleep disturbances. It should be appreciated that NPNs may truly have a broad range of symptoms, ranging from no symptoms at all to absolutely debilitating symptoms that drastically affect the quality of life of those afflicted. In general, essential thrombocytosis tends to be the least symptomatic of the group, followed by polycythemia, and finally myelofibrosis, which is typically the most symptomatic. In the symptomatic individual, symptoms such as fatigue, abdominal pain, night sweats, bone pain, fever, weight loss, depressed mood, sleeping, and sexual disturbances can all really reduce the quality of life, particularly when these symptoms are experienced together as a constellation of symptoms. Medication side effects may also contribute to a decreased quality of life. I stress again the importance of communicating this to the healthcare team so therapy can be optimized. In addition to communicating with healthcare providers, communication to friends and family is critically important. Share the diagnosis of NPM to all loved ones so they may be better equipped to understand your symptoms and more prepared to support you when needed. Supportive care from loved ones can go a long way in improving quality of life. Finally, how can you reduce complications associated with NPM? In general, it's important to follow the instructions provided by your healthcare provider, including medication compliance, attending routine checkups, and obtaining labs as recommended. Be an effective communicator to all members of the healthcare team. Be diligent in assessing symptoms, particularly those which would signify a medical emergency, but also those more subtle symptoms. And finally, optimize your overall health with diet, exercise, and stress reduction techniques. So in conclusion, NPMs represent a spectrum of disorders which may be associated with a heavy symptomatic burden. Abnormal blood counts and an enlarged spleen associated with the disorder can lead to a variety of symptoms. Understanding your symptoms, why they occur, and the importance of communication of these symptoms to your healthcare provider are important to obtain the best possible outcome when faced with this disease. I hope you feel empowered from the knowledge you've gained so far and recognize that self-education is a continual process and is truly critical for you to become an active participant in the management of your disease. Thank you so much for your participation today and congratulate yourself on taking the initiative towards self-education. Remember, knowledge is power. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Gowan. That was really so very wonderful, actually, and very helpful to people, and indeed very empowering, all the details and information. So thank you so much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Sarah Kelly. Ms. Kelly is an oncology social worker, and she's coordinator of our older adult services at Cancer Care. And Ms. Kelly is going to address the Cancer Care's free psychosocial support services, as well as the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. As Dr. Messner said, I'm an oncology social worker here, and I work with many people who are diagnosed with MPN and also their family members and their support network. And I love the call today because really what we've been talking about is quality of life issues, managing your care, and what I'd like to talk about is how cancer care can be a part of that care and really be a part of that important support network. So just a little bit about who we are. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling. We do that face-to-face in the New York area and then over the telephone nationally. We have support groups that we also do face-to-face in the New York area. We do them over the phone nationally and then also online nationally and internationally. We have education programs like the one we're on today. We provide practical help. We can assist you navigate the healthcare system. We also provide some limited financial assistance as well as chemotherapy copay assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers, and the services are completely free of charge. And oncology social workers really are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, really the support network. We're also trained to help patients and their supports tackle the problems that accompany the disease, financial demands, physical changes, just the social adjustment. I know Dr. Gowan talked a lot about that, the psychological impact and care. I think adjusting to and finding ways of coping with the diagnosis is a huge part and a very important part of the healing process. As you may know, cancer really affects the whole person and the entire support network. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. And one of the things I'd like for you to take with you is that you don't have to do this on your own. You don't have to walk the path alone. Really, joining a support group, you're connecting with others who are going through a similar situation or having similar problems. With individual counseling, that's a space that's just yours to voice any concerns and navigate any of the issues I mentioned earlier. And really, these connections help lessen the isolation that many people diagnosed are experiencing. I think that feeling well emotionally helps you better deal with the diagnosis and treatment. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about what we have available now. We currently have an online support group for anyone who is diagnosed with a blood cancer. And then additionally, we do caregiver groups, we do a phone group and a face-to-face group. We have general patient groups, both face-to-face and on the phone. And then, of course, we also provide the individual counseling, which we do face-to-face and over the phone. If you're interested in any of these services, please call our HOPE line. It's 1-800-813-HOPE or 1-800-813-4673. And I also recommend visiting our website. We have a very comprehensive website, and that's www.cancercare.org. And on the website, you'll find information not only on support and our services, but also just all of the programs that we have, as well as literature and publications on your diagnosis and treatment and also coping. So I think, you know, we've learned a lot from today's program. There's been a lot of information to get our arms around. And we're here. Cancer Care is here to help you understand what it means for you and your family. So, you know, if you have questions about today's program or if it's really brought up some other issues you'd like to discuss, please, please call us. And again, remember you're not alone in this. Cancer Care Services are here to help you. Thanks so much for your attention and the opportunity to speak today.
Oh, thank you so much, Sarah. Very informative and all the wonderful services of Cancer Care at people's really at their fingertips, so that's wonderful. And now we have time for questions. We have lots of time for questions, so I'm going to ask Kate to bring all of our speakers on board for the questions, and I'm going to ask Kate to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we'll take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get your question today, please do know that you can just call us at our 800 number, and I'll go over that again with you toward the end of the call, but let's see how many of your questions you can take right now. Kate?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit a question by clicking Ask a Question. And again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question at this time, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone.
And we have a question from one of our online participants, from Claudia. So the question is ET a form of cancer? Dr. Michaelis, if you could address that, please.
Sure. So it is considered a neoplasm, and that means cancer. And the reason is because we have determined that the condition of ET is the result of the inappropriate proliferation of these stem cells, these abnormal seed cells in the bone marrow. The word cancer just means that there's a group of cells, whether or not it's in the prostate or the pancreas or the breast, which all derive from one abnormal original cell. So yes, we do use the word cancer to describe ET. However, unlike the examples I gave of breast or pancreas cancer, ET is very, very indolent, meaning it is often present for long periods of time without causing any particular problems. It's not aggressive most of the time, and therefore, that word has frightening connotations, just because something is actually classified scientifically as a cancer doesn't mean that it means the same to the individual that has it.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from the line of Irma H. Your line is open. Irma?
Hello. Good afternoon.
Hi, Irma.
I just want to ask a question that being a breast cancer, if the bone type, I had a problem with my spine to the back, and that leaves me now, you know, with a kind of stiffness around the waist, and I'm taking treatment right now, but I'm getting a numbness in the feet. So I want to know what can I do about that, if there's any treatment.
And do you have breast cancer, is that what you're saying? Or
I'm a breast cancer patient.
Okay, and you have what we call?
Diagnosed with stage 4.
And you have, like, neuropathy in your feet?
The numbness in the feet. But the worst is with the back, but I have this thing with the spine. Mm-hmm. The spine has damage, and it has me, you know, with a pain, a stiffness around the waist.
Well, we appreciate your question. Irma, that's an excellent question. Although the program isn't on breast cancer, I think that we probably can give some general thoughts about dealing with this neuropathy, which we then will invite you to go back to your treating healthcare team, since the program today is on a different type of cancer. Because it's a side effect, I'm wondering if Dr. Gowan or Dr. Michaels could adjust the concept of neuropathy, what that word means. It's a kind of a fancy term for what actually Irma has really more eloquently described in terms of the numbness in her feet and some things that sometimes people find helpful, and then, of course, to go back to Irma's go back to her healthcare team.
So in breast cancer, very often the chemotherapies that are administered in breast cancer cause damage to the nerves, and that can be experienced by the patient by some numbness, tingling, and pain. Because of that, we definitely take this symptom quite seriously. It's very prevalent in our breast cancer population. But unfortunately, there's nothing to do to fix it. There are medications that can help to moderate the sensation of the numbness, tingling, and pain. Things that are actually anticonvulsant medications, but as a side effect, they actually are very good for this kind of pain called neuropathic pain. And some examples of kinds of medications for which we may use include gabapentin or Lyrica, amongst many others. And what I recommend, particularly in stage 4 breast cancer patients with neuropathy and probably other pain issues, is to perhaps seek an evaluation by a pain management and end-of-life care specialist called a palliative care medicine doctor. Now, these doctors really focus on dealing with neuropathic pain or neuropathy, as well as all other kinds of cancer pain, and maybe the best person to seek for you to help you with your symptom sequelae.
Excellent recommendations. And the other thing is with neuropathy, do you want to comment, actually, Dr. Gowan, about just the role of rehabilitation medicine or physical therapy or proper shoes in terms of just risk of not feeling your bottom of your feet, so the risk of falling and things like that, to really be careful about that?
Really excellent point, Dr. Mesner. And part of neuropathy is not just the numbness, tingling, and pain, but also the propensity for having falls at home. And so some fall prevention techniques are certainly to remove rugs from your home, be sure that there are no cords which are exposed, and then absolutely to seek the help of a pain and rehabilitation physician who perhaps can recommend some supportive walkers or devices at home to ensure that you are being as safe as you possibly can be.
Excellent. Thank you. That's really important, and that's actually true for everyone on the call, just to be so aware of just or is that an issue also, Dr. McKellis, for all the other MPNs that you discussed today in terms of just the safety, in terms of, you know, of walking and safety and risk of falling and things like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think getting engaged in your own care in terms of one of the things that I think is important is keeping track of whether or not you are having neuropathic symptoms. It's not as common in MPNs as it can be in individuals that get chemotherapy for breast cancer or other tumors like our colleague Irma has, but neuropathy can occur. And so like Dr. Gowan mentioned, keeping a symptom diary, understanding what it might be related to. Unfortunately, there are some other conditions like diabetes or the use of alcohol, which can cause neuropathy, those kind of things. So we want to make sure that we attribute it to the right thing and that we control it as early as possible because it is hard to reverse. And then in terms of safety in the house, of course, I mean, that goes to anybody who's anemic, who might be dizzy, or who's having side effects from medicine needs to be careful not to add problems with being unstable.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from the line of Alita E. Your line is open.
Yes. Okay. I'm an ET patient, actually, but I had a problem with my telephone earlier, so I was late. Is there a way I can listen to the first 20, 30 minutes?
Oh, absolutely. So this program will be on replay, both on the telephone and also as a podcast. And for those of you who have a computer, give it for the podcast, for the replay on the computer, the webcast part of it, I would give it till tomorrow. And for the telephone replay, I would give it a couple of hours, so by this evening it should be up. I'm happy to give that number to you at this point. Are you listening? Do you like to listen on the phone or on the computer? I'll give it to you anyway, because some of the others may want to listen to it. And you also may want to listen to it again, even if you did listen to the whole thing, because, you know, the more you listen to it, the more different things you hear.
Yes.
So first you call. So there's a main number. So does everyone have a pencil and paper handy?
Yeah,
And I'll repeat this at the end. We'll also send information to all of you about the replay as well. So thank you for asking that excellent question. So to access the replay, you call 1-800-625-5288. I'm going to repeat that number again. You would call, this is just the replays for all of our cancer care teleconferences, 1-800-625-5288. And then you need to give a code because every program has its own code. So the code for today's program is 164-4290. And I'll repeat the code again, 164-4290. And for those of you who want to listen to this as a podcast, you would just go to the Cancer Care website, www.cancercare.org, and you would be able to listen to the it'll explain to you how to go ahead and listen to the replay on the Connect workshops. Okay, thank you. Excellent audience. Okay, our next question, Stephanie.
Our next question comes from the line of Felicia B. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I've been an ET patient for a long time, and I am on hydroxyurea as a treatment because my platelets are just really inordinately high. And in 2009, I changed oncologists because I was having other health issues, and my oncologist was just having issues himself. So I switched, and the new doctor had said that in 2009, the World Health Organization had changed their guidelines as far as treatment regarding how low the platelets go. So the doctor's now has me on a super low dose compared to what I used to be on. And my platelets run around 1 million. And I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that at all, or if you have any thoughts on that treatment guidelines from the WHO.
Oh, thank you so much. Dr. McKellis, would you want
to... Sure.
Michael,
so your question points to one of the great questions in the field, and that is whether or not there's a perfect number for us with inessential thrombocythemia to keep the platelets at. And it used to be that, I'm going to say So first off, it depends a little bit on your risk stratification. For an individual that's had an event like a blood clot, an arterial clot like a stroke or a problem in their heart, or a venous blood clot like a clot in the leg or the lungs, then oftentimes in my practice, I try and aim for a platelet count that's lower than what they had when they had that event. In the absence of that, so if somebody's never had a problem or a significant complication related to platelets, then we don't know exactly the perfect number to keep it. There has been some historical trials, meaning trials where we look backwards in time and see where trouble arises with patients, and sometimes that has said, well, it's probably good to keep the platelets in the range of about 600,000. But that's never been validated in trials where we look forward. And it also, we just don't have the magic number. We don't know for sure what's the right count. Now, that's different than when we talk about red blood cells. With red blood cells, we do know that you want your hematocrit percentage to be under 45. So what's the bottom line here? The bottom line is that the national guidelines don't tell us in low-risk patients, people without clots, what's the best platelet number. Some people do aim for lower than a million, but there's no magic there. And sometimes you have to balance the amount of hydrea and the side effects from the hydrea with keeping people's platelets in the range that they ought to be. One thing that you might ask your doctor is, are there guidelines that we should look at for how low the platelets ought to be? Am I responding to the amount of hydrea? Do I need to be on additional agents? Those are all questions that you might want to ask your doctor. But there's no hard and fast rule about the perfect platelet number. It depends a little bit on your history and with the other risk factors that you face for clotting or bleeding. We do know that when platelets get too high, the risk actually for bleeding goes up.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question, Stephanie.
Our next question comes from the line of Christy H. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question. My husband was diagnosed with polycythemia vera at age 36 after he was admitted to the hospital with a blood clot. And since his diagnosis, he's been part of a clinical study at the Mayo Clinic, which has ended. But he responded well to the treatment and the therapy there. But prior to that treatment and since that treatment, he's always experienced a lot of issues with spleen size and discomfort resulting from an enlarged spleen. And currently his only treatment is phlebotomies. But my question is anyone on the panel aware of any other treatment options, I guess, other than medication that could assist in reducing the size of the spleen?
Well, thank you. That's an excellent question. Dr. Michaels, could you address that?
Yeah, so we don't know how to reduce the size of the spleen in the absence of medication. There's no particular food or exercise or other interventions that have shown benefit to decreasing the size of the spleen. There is the use of this medicine called ruxolitinib. Ruxolitinib has not yet been approved by the FDA for the treatment of splenomegaly and polycythemia vera, but it is something that's being submitted to the Food and Drug Administration and may soon be something that's available. In general, ruxolitinib is used off-label, meaning at the discretion of the provider, in individuals with polycythemia vera where symptoms that are severe or particularly bothersome and blood counts point to the need to sort of more imaginative approaches to the treatment. So ruxolitinib, which does have evidence in myelofibrosis, has been used to decrease the spleen size in people with polycythemia vera in clinical trials. That may have been the clinical trial your husband was in. I don't know. However, what I would say is the answer to your direct question, is there a non-medical treatment for spleen size? Not really. the answer to whether or not a medicine would work is whether or not this medicine, ruxolitinib, once it's either approved or if your physician feels that it's something that should be considered off-label. It depends a little bit on the severity. I will tell you that ruxolitinib, while we've had more and more good experience with it, it's only been around since it was first introduced to the early phase trials in 2007. So it's not a medicine that we have a huge amount of time experience with, and so therefore we can't predict what it does over long periods of time or how long people can respond to it. These are all important questions to discuss with your physician.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And we have another question now for Dr. Gawin. I have a PV. My ferritin level is now less than 1%. Does this contribute to fatigue? Could my low ferritin cause other problems?
Really great question. If low ferritin is actually what we really strive for in the treatment for polycythemia vera, that's what phlebotomy actually is trying to do, is to remove iron from the bloodstream, from the marrow stores, so that the red blood cells can no longer form out of control like they were prior to being iron deficient. So a low ferritin is really exactly what we want. And I anticipate that you likely are not anemic because you have the concurrent diagnosis of PV. So I think the fatigue is less likely to be related to the ferritin and more likely to be related to the overall disease process of the NPN.
Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. This has been an extraordinary call. I have to say that our speakers have been terrific, and actually our participants have been amazing with questions both online and on the telephone, and they're really asking such really very informed questions and really excellent questions that we do advise you all to take back, of course, to your treating healthcare team. In addition, I do want to, again, repeat some numbers for all of you that have been asked earlier. In case you want to listen to the program again on the telephone or on our cancer care website, I'm going to give you that number again. If you want to listen to this program again on the telephone, you just call 1-800-625-5288, and there's an access code you would use, 164-4290. Also, I do also, as Ms. Kelly had said, I want to remind all of you of all the services that you can access from Cancer Care. Although our program is soon to end, our services from Cancer Care, those continue endlessly. So we don't want anyone to leave this call today feeling that you are alone. We want you to know that you're part of a community of support here and that we're here to help you. And that means that we provide practical and financial assistance, support groups on the telephone and online. We offer counseling services. We have these type of workshops. And we also offer a host of publications and materials. Also, there is a part two to this program. So there is a program on November 12th, on Wednesday, November 12th, finding the resources you need to manage the costs of living with myeloproliferative neoplasms. So we do encourage, many of you have signed up for this already, but if you haven't, we encourage you to sign up for this program as well. Most importantly, as we conclude today, I want you to know that we are simply a phone call away for all of you. And the number for Cancer Care to call for services is 1-800-813-HOPE. And we do encourage you to go ahead and call if you didn't get to ask your question. If you have other questions you think of in the next couple of days or weeks, do call us. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.